Good seeing everybody.
Yes, one point, if I could. One issue with the closing this morning. Mr. Kogan referred to Exhibit 1550, which is that email in which Mr. Fumo says, see if there's a subpoena for Howard Kane's computer. And he referred to another email as well that came from the Sprague firm. And he made the point that these items were not recovered off of the PC card of Mr. Fumo. His argument being, Mr. Fumo is not manufacturing a defense by keeping things that are helpful to him. The problem with that is that we have no idea whether it's on the PC card or not. Pursuant to Your Honor's order, the only documents we have of communications between Mr. Sprague and Mr. Fumo were produced by Mr. Fumo and by the Sprague firm pursuant to Your Honor's order, which was a limited lifting of the attorney-client privilege, so they could produce what they said was relevant to this advice of counsel issue. We never searched the PC card for any communications between, in fact, we had them screened out. You might remember that the technician testified about how that was done. So we're kind of stuck here with the record being closed and without any opportunity, without a further order, to investigate any number of things that might be on the PC.
Okay, well, let me shortcut it one moment before you respond, Mr. Kogan. As I understand it, you're done with that particular phase of your closing?
Yes, but there's one thing I'd just like to say. First of all, that's my understanding of the evidence. But more importantly, the 15999 has nothing to do with Sprague. That's between Luchko and Fumo. That's the one where he says, I don't want – no, he does forward something to Sprague later on. But I don't care about that. It's the email itself that's between Luchko and Fumo where he's saying, I don't care what of Ruth Arneo's they recover. Also, with respect to the Howard Kane business, the Howard Kane business is that's between about don't touch anything until you check with Jeff Johnson, he says, you know, to Charlie Hoffman, which is published to more than one person other than the lawyer. But more importantly, his communication is that he thinks this could be under subpoena. He's communicating both with Luchko and Hoffman about that. And then in that email also, he sends a copy of that, as I understand it, to Johnson. So this would not have been covered anyway by any kind of privilege. This does not bounce out of the privilege because of any kind of limited advice of counsel defense. It's on the same email.
That's not true. Luchko was a co-defendant. There was a joint defense agreement. We abided by these.
I understand that now, but I can't resolve this issue now. I can resolve it at the end of the day. It makes some more concrete resolution of it than right now. I only ask Mr. Kogan if he was done with that particular area.
I'm not going to go back to it. There's about 2 minutes that I forgot about with respect to obstruction. It's not going to do with the emails. It's going to refer back to something from 1476 without showing that email again for the 100th time in this case. I wanted to say one thing, and then I'm going to move on.
Okay. And then we'll take up that issue at the end of the day.
Okay,
Please be seated as you come in, folks.
It's to everybody's good fortune that I'm really getting tired. So let me just move on as best I can. The one last thing, I don't want you to think it was an intentional lie. It was just something that slipped my mind when I talked about obstruction of justice. No more emails on obstruction of justice, I promise you. I'm just going to say this to you. If you had in front of you right now that exhibit that you have seen more times than you'll ever be able to forget in your life, you can probably 3 years from now recall what 1476 said, and that is what you know. But I want you to think back to the government's theory of this case about cover-up in the context of the following. Without getting again into all the people who got it and all the rest of it, what did the government tell us about what part of Vince Fumo's paranoia is? They don't use the word paranoia, I say, in terms of privacy, concern about government intrusion and invasions. When he talks in 1994 to that fellow Hollander, just at the time he says, you know, things are going on, even when Bill Clinton's president of the United States, how he's being attacked himself. What the government said in this case throughout regarding his concerns include the Hollander exchange, where he says, Hollander does, about this government ability to tap into your computer. And, of course, he thinks, through this carnivore, that the government can take literally every keystroke from your computer. Does that sound like it would make any sense at all that a man with that state of mind would think that he is corruptly influencing somebody knowingly with consciousness of wrongdoing when he sends emails out like the ones you saw to 24 staffers, 29 staffers, this guy thinking that the government's got the ability all along to be getting it simultaneously with these other people? Now, having said that, Citizens Alliance, Ed Jacobs spoke about it at great length, so I'm just going to touch on a few points, and then I'm going to move on. And what I want to start with, in rather quick order, is one of the things that Mr. Zosmer said in his closing about shifting defenses. That is, you know, they had this defense once before when back in 2004 or 5, and then it even shifted during the trial. That I thought Mr. Zosmer said, he said, that the defense was that this was a fundraiser's fee that Mr. Fumo got, which turns out to be these consumer goods and tools worth, based on the real math, not, you know, the painstaking math the government did where they were wrong in terms of the numbers, but in terms of the real math, getting $10,000-$11,000 a year, rather than, as Senator Fumo said in his own clumsy way, it would be like them buying my family dinner every week at the Palm or something like that. That's how much it would come out to be, not thinking that this is, you know, anything other than that kind of a gift, and that's all. But the government said the defense starts out with a different theory, that we said it was a fundraiser's fee. Now they're saying it's some kind of a gift, some kind of, you know, perk. I just would like you to remember, if you can remember back without me doing it, that's fine. Congratulations. I wouldn't be able to do it if I didn't read it back. But when I opened to the jury, you, back that day in October, here's what I said. And I want you to remember this in the context of what Mr. Zosmer insisted upon when he was talking about frivolous defenses, frivolous defenses. You can't make this up. You can't make this up. They started out by saying it's a fundraiser's fee. Now they're saying it's, you know, some perk, some gift, some compensation in kind. Here's what I said. Under 501c3 law, it is permissible to pay reasonable compensation, one, even commissions, percentages of money you bring in to the fundraiser. That guy who calls you on the phone at night when you go home asking you for money for the FOP or soliciting for the Heart Foundation, that person's usually getting a commission. Heads of big foundations get huge commissions sometimes, 10%, 20%, 30%. You're going to hear in testimony in this case, that's why it's a long case. But he never demanded a commission. He never said, I brought $17 million in. You're going to find out for all of the 501c3s in the United States, not just the 37,000, of all of them, the average fundraising costs are 24 cents on the dollar. Now, my friend Jacobs here is better with math than I am, but you do the math. 24 cents on the dollar is going to come out to be like north of $4 million. What's he charged with in this case, I say? He got some consumer goods as compensation in kind. That's what the government says. Or he got or received some tools. This guy who wants other people's money, that's the allegation. The government well knew that I never took the position that this was a fundraiser's fee. What I say to you now, what Mr. Jacobs says to you now, what you can say to each other in the jury deliberation room is this. It remains uncontradicted in this case. We brought it out through Beckman, the only 501c3 guy in this case who really understands any of this, despite the fact that he made some accounting mistakes that Mr. Jacobs pointed out. Beckman said, in response to my question, we accept my representation that it's as much as 24 cents on the dollar, fundraiser's fees, and he said yes. So that if you start with the proposition that he would have been entitled to a fundraiser's fee, put this in perspective with the mantra, other people's money, because it sounds so good. Mr. Zosmer, four times, OPM extravaganza. If you put in perspective that we're talking about upwards of $4 million for the $17 million of private PICO money that came in. Now, the government can say all day long, PICO's not private, it's public. This is litigation in his capacity as a senator. He was in this in his private individual capacity. No one from the Internal Revenue comes in here and says for a second that he would have not been entitled to upwards of $4 million, and if you pay, you know, the appropriate tax on it, you're still going to come out north of $2 million, and what we're talking about in this case is what you heard. And as Mr. Jacobs said to you, with all the people in the world that they call, I mean, the witnesses, Mr. Bruns, about whether, you know, the Gazella was a historically significant ship worthy of having a painting of it hung in the Seaport Museum, or somebody about French cooking and things like that. One person, even the director of the Internal Revenue, coming in here and saying to anybody, under any circumstances, that anything that Citizens Alliance gave him, call it gifts or compensation in kind or anything else like that, would have been inappropriate given what he did for them. So now what does it come down to in terms of what the government is saying? We shift gears again and we go to this question of, well, is it appropriate under the Ethics Act for him to take it, something that he's not charged with? And let's go past that for a second. That is, well, if it is compensation in kind as opposed to a gift, if we construe it that way, then those consumer goods and those other things should have been declared as income. That's what it comes down to. That is, if you got a 1099 for what you did, and if it comes out to be $12,000 a year. So what we're talking about now is a crime that's not charged here. He evaded or avoided $12,000 or $11,000 or $10,000 in income. This man, who before the roof caved in on him, is declaring upwards of seven figures a year, paying taxes of $400,000 to $500,000 a year. That's what this was all about, to save another $3,000 in taxes. But he's not charged with that any more than he's charged with that Ethics Act violation that we talked about before. And then it really gets interesting. What's interesting about it is that we have this dispute about which act applies. Is it the legislative code of conduct? I don't want to hear about this anymore. This is going out the window with the computer tonight. Legislative code of conduct or the other Ethics Act, Mr. Jacobs, when he's cross-examining Contino, let's talk about my Ethics Act, Mr. Jacobs says, as opposed to your Ethics Act. In my Ethics Act, meaning the legislative code of ethics, that's the specific one that applies to a legislature.
like a legislator, like Senator Fumo. Am I right? Yeah, he said, that's right. And then if there's something in the other Ethics Act that applies, that would apply too. So let's just start out with what everybody has been saying, and that is under the Legislative Code of Ethics. The Legislative Code of Ethics, there are prohibitions about what someone in elective office there at the Senate can get. And so if you go to the prohibition section, I can do it better from here. I can see it better from here. The prohibitions in section 143.5 are as follows. I'm going to paraphrase this. You can't knowingly solicit a gift or accept anything for any compensation which other than that to which he is duly entitled from the Commonwealth, which is intended to influence the performance of his official duties or which would influence the performance of his official duties, nor shall any member solicit, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you go down further, you're going to see that there are various prohibitions that this applies to, and they give you, no member shall receive compensation for anything of economic value for any consultation. You go, further. Of course, this does not apply to other things that he's not, that a legislator wouldn't get that has nothing to do with trying to influence his official position as a senator. But then if you go to the next page, after all the things that are prohibited, if you go to the next page, in what none of us want to look at again, I hope, is these subsections that include the prohibitions at the point where Mr. Shapiro has it highlighted, it says those subsections A, B, C, and D of this section 5, which is what I just read, shall not apply to, and then subsection 2, participation in the affairs of charitable, religious, nonprofit, education, etc. This is perfectly legal, not unethical in any way. So now there's the next dispute that comes up. Well, how about the other ethics code, the one that Contino was talking about? If you go into that, and I have to go into it again because you've seen it and it's an exhibit in the case, but let me just paraphrase it. What Senator Fumo is saying when he's on the witness stand, and is basically saying, I'm not even thinking about any of this, but if you look at it, what he's saying is that gift is gift something that has to be disclosed on your Senate financial disclosure form. If the gift is something less than what you give. In other words, if I do this work for Citizens Alliance, all the stuff you heard about, real estate, all the rest of it, and I get back what I got back, until you get to the point, he's saying, where what I am getting is greater than what I gave, you don't have to disclose it. And then Mr. Zosmer gets up and he says, well, then there's another definition of income, but is it income if it's a gift? And it's really confusing. Let me say this. As His Honor said at the very beginning of this case, one of the first things he said when he came down here, spoke from the same podium that I'm at now, unless they changed the podium, I'm not sure. But he spoke and he said, trials frequently are a clash of interpretations. So let's look at that. If he had disclosed this, along with the other extraordinary disclosures, do you think there's any evidence in the world out there that anybody discloses the list that he's disclosing? You saw what his disclosure form looks like. And if he's thinking about it at the time and he discloses this, there's no problem, because under the Legislative Code of Ethics, it's proper to get this. So what are we talking about? The fact is, there is a clash of interpretations, and it's not important here because, in fact, if he didn't disclose something on the financial disclosure form that includes these consumer goods and these other things we're talking about, that's not what's charged here. Just like, as I said before, and I don't like to repeat myself, let me get past it real fast, we're not talking about failing to disclose it as additional income on top of all the other money that he was making, because that's not charged in this case either, a tax violation like that. The tax violations in this case deal with the 990s and the Citizen Alliance return for 2003. That's what we're talking about in this case. So I just wanted you to keep that in mind. And again, what's of great significance here is this. Citizens Alliance doesn't exist without him. And I'm not talking about you know, the public money, which obviously he's the sole and exclusive benefactor of all Citizens Alliance money, period, end of story. We're not talking about the public money now. We're talking about the private money. That $17 million that goes to, who's the fraud? Who is injured here? Citizens Alliance gets to do all these things that Citizens Alliance couldn't possibly do had that money not gone to Citizens Alliance in the first place. So who's the victim? The victim is, the government suggests, the government, because this should have been somehow all disclosed to the government, but who speaks for Citizens Alliance? We're talking about not the returns. That's a separate charge. Should something have been disclosed on the returns? They're separate charges, those tax charges against him. The Citizens Alliance and Citizens Alliance Holdings tax returns, which has certain lines where these things, if they're not gifts, should have been disclosed. Clash of interpretations as to what they were. But if, in fact, they should have been disclosed, Citizens Alliance isn't. Who speaks for Citizens Alliance? The board? Is it Ruth Arneo, who's both a member of the board and the executive director? Who is it? Citizens Alliance is not like a corporation with shareholders, where the shareholder would be injured as well, would be victimized as well. Citizens Alliance is this charitable entity. It is not a fraud on the donor, like PICO, that gave the money. It's not a fraud on the Senate. That's a separate charge in this case. It's not a fraud on Citizens Alliance. Citizens Alliance is not victimized here at all. Do they speak through their board of directors? Is that what it is? Did any one of them even suggest to you for a second that they would have had a problem with any of this if, in fact, they knew anything about it? Now, in addition to that, the government says to you, well, when Vince Fumo sent Jeff Johnson over to basically, you know, look into the affairs to make sure everything was in order, what did he disclose to them, what didn't he disclose to them, and all the rest? He didn't send them over there with preconditions about what to do. Jeff Johnson looks into all this and makes representations to the board that everything is in order. Did he do a good job or not? I don't know. We know what they did on the obstruction of justice end of this case. Maybe they didn't. But the last thing you're going to do if you're a guy in my client's position, if you think you've done anything wrong, is to send a lawyer over there and say, you look into this. Check it out. He didn't say without restriction. He didn't say don't talk to Ruth Arneo. He doesn't say anything like that. So that's the Citizens Alliance end of this, but from my perspective, except for two small other things. The way this is set up, so that we're all on the same page, is while Citizens Alliance is a separate entity, when they get this private PICO money and they're able to do the things they're doing beyond just the constituent services that they've done in the past, I mean, the kinds of, you know, graffiti removal, trash collection, lots that get cleared that nobody ever even thought about clearing, alleys that get cleaned that nobody ever thought of cleaning because we just don't do that in the city of Philadelphia. We can't afford even when things were well, you know, in the economy. And when Citizens Alliance, brings out its trash trucks, do you remember the day Rendell becomes mayor and they're cleaning up, you know, City Hall, and the streets department says, hey, can we use your trash trucks? Because these are really great trash trucks. This is what Citizens Alliance is doing, constituent service work. And even later on, now it's constituent service work on a grand scale with the $17 million. We're talking not just about, you know, doing those things that you heard about, but we're talking about community and economic development. Now, this is not the other stuff that Senator Fumo has done through the Senate during his long career, the things that Ken Snyder was talking about and other people, and you'll see some more of this in the testimony that I review about Verone in a few minutes. But this is a constituent service arm of the Senate office. That's how this is contemplated by them. And that's why this synergism of having everybody in the same building, where constituents are coming in all the time, and you've got Ruth Arneo and Jamie Spagna doing their Citizens Alliance work, and you're getting referrals from the Senate office over to Citizens Alliance, and you've got the administration of Citizens Alliance. This is why this works. This is why this is good for Citizens Alliance, who has a mission. It's not a mission just to go out and make money, you know, like through the charter schools or the $750,000 that was generated when the high-tech ventures went belly up because, you know, the dot-com bubble, when the, you know, just basically the dot-coms went out of business. We're talking about Citizens Alliance making $750,000 from the building that he sold, where high-tech ventures was. All these things, they're getting done. And But Citizens Alliance is more than that. It's the mission is to do what you know. Community economic development, doing things in the city of Philadelphia. Now we have this thing about, well, the mission statement said Philadelphia. IRS is somehow trickier. And then Ed Jacob showed you at least five times that's not the only language in there. And anything else a 501c3 should be. But can you imagine this? The IRS and Citizens Alliance is being fooled because the government of the United States would have said, you're going 10 miles up the road to Bucks County? That's not the mission. You got to stay in Philadelphia. 501c3 would say Pennsylvania and New Jersey. You crazy? You can't do that. All we're concerned about is Philadelphia. That's silly. It's silly beyond words. Anything a 501c3 is not prohibited from doing. It's as simple as that. Now, they say he stole hundreds of thousands of dollars, 200-some thousand dollars for polling. Not money that goes into his pocket for polling. That's part of the grand theft in this case. Other people's money. Come on. There's an honest disagreement, perhaps, among certain people. For the government to get up here in the opening statement say, political activity is prohibited. Talk about changing positions, what they learned during this case. Jacobs pointed out, and the accountants pointed out, that's just not true. Political activity is not prohibited. FUMO on the stand says, polls like this, just the other day, the Pew Foundation did one of these polls. You heard him say that on the stand. About, you know, the political climate, how people are doing in elective office and things like that. The prohibition you heard, I'm not going to go through with it again. You know what it is. He made a mistake, he said. He didn't know the Global was being paid for the Fitzpatrick stuff, you know, out of Citizens Alliance money. But now let's put it all in perspective. Polling, $200-some thousand. Now the lawyers are involved in it. You know, lawyers, like a committee. It's, you know, a committee of lawyers, as people say, you know, is a, you know, a camel that was a horse that a committee made. I mean, of lawyers. Lawyers get involved in stuff, and things really get interesting. So now what they're doing is they're trying, in the middle of this investigation, lawyers are in the case, and they understand from dialogue and understand from what they're doing what the government's position is here, that somehow there's something wrong with the polling. So what do? They say, just pay it. Just like with, you know, the sweet distraction later on that I'm going to touch on when we talk about the Seaport Museum. And this phony bill gets generated when Carter's got some heat on him because maybe he's gone beyond what he should be doing by letting FUMO have the sweet distraction. And then Sprague hears about it from the guy from the Beasley firm, remember Hill? He says, just pay. It's not a question of we did something wrong. You think maybe they'll go away if they're satisfied that this was never intentional, that this is a clash of interpretations. That's what this is. You know, every step of the way, when they take a corrective measure, not because they think they're wrong necessarily, not because the lawyers think they did wrong or anything else, it's a clash of just pay it. Maybe they'll go away. And so what does he do? He gets money. Not just to pay back the Fitzpatrick poll. He gets money to pay back all the polls. You know, the kind of stuff that, according to any definition, and my friend went over this, I don't want to say ad nauseum, I don't get him angry at me. We went over this in great detail, what you're allowed to do. Lobbying, other kinds of polling and stuff like that. The so-called expert accountants, other than Beckman, who didn't know, you know, other than Beckman, they didn't know anything. You can do this stuff. So what's he do? Other people's money, it takes him two shakes of a lamb's tail to get $200-some thousand, the largest fundraiser among Democrats in the country as a legislator, to get the money and pay it back. He could have done this any time he wanted if he thought it was prohibited. This is the guy who went to Ken Snyder and said, when they wanted to do a poll on the John Street race and all that, you remember, and who would do better a couple years from now, it's not going to be used in a campaign for against another candidate. It tells FUMO who maybe he should be backing later on. Okay? Is that to the benefit of Citizens Alliance? If FUMO knows how he should spend his political capital so that Citizens Alliance and things like he's doing for constituents is benefited from it? Clash of interpretations. I know what a reasonable position is. The government can take whatever position it wants.
And how easy is it for them to get political action committee money to pay for the polls they could have paid for in the first place if they thought there was anything prohibited about this? He gets money, and you can see that they patched up. John Street's political action committee sends him money to just, you know, and he's got his own political action committee money. They raised this in less than a week, and they pay back not just for the Fitzpatrick poll that Vince thought they shouldn't have charged Citizens Alliance for in the first place, but all the polls. Hold that against them, that they did that. This is a guilty mind. This is bad intent, where with complete transparency, they pay it back, because that's the position they take. Now, forget about, you know, what Jeff Johnson did when he went to see Jay Johnson up in New York and said, well, why don't you just give us the money back and we'll give you a new check? And he said, what, crazy? Why don't you just, you know, have your company, whatever pack you have, pay them back? And that's exactly the way they handled it. So one last thing about Citizens Alliance, and that is this. As the constituent service arm, or an arm, of the Senate office, when you have people who are doing the kind of work that Christian Marone is later doing for Citizens Alliance Holding, Passyunk Avenue revitalization, high-tech ventures, buying and selling real estate, all the money that's being donated to the police department, all the things they're doing, getting a police van, surveillance van for drug cases and stuff like that, all that money that is coming in and being spent is part of this use of Citizens Alliance and Citizens Alliance Holdings as a constituent service arm. Does the Senate do well on that? That they're getting constituent services and community and economic development without it costing the state 1 cent? Of course they are. So what happens? When Marone and Coyne come to Vince and they say, you know, it's not fair. The Senate pays educational costs for people if it's a state-related institution they went to matriculate. And Vince says, well, he says to Marone, you did work on high-tech ventures. And obviously what we're talking about here is he did work far and above the call of duty. I mean, the high-tech venture stuff is part of the constituent service work that's part of the Senate duties to get all this stuff done in the community. But he did so much on it, and we will see this later on when we get to the Marone part of the case, that he's getting that money. And clash of interpretations? I think not. But in any event, we leave it to you. Is it appropriate to do it that way? Certainly no fraud. No fraud at all. And then later on, you heard the explanation about Coyne, which he didn't tell him to make up a phony invoice. Invoice it for education, which is a mission of Citizens Alliance. Okay, now, it would be a good time, I think, having talked about Citizens Alliance, to talk very briefly about the tax counts, and this should take me no more than a few minutes. What the government is saying in this case is that even though my client is not a signer of these returns, he aided and abetting the filing of false returns to the Internal Revenue. I really just want to take a second or two just to make sure you understand. He is charged with aiding and abetting the filing of those false returns. Even though he doesn't sign it, there is no evidence that he ever saw them or reviewed them with any accountant or anybody else. I mean, this is really a stretch. Never saw anything like this. You can't make this up. Flagrant violations. They charge somebody with the tax filing charges because they want you to assume that he knew what the returns reflected, having hardly ever seen his own returns that Roseanne puts together for him with the accountants, that he studied a 990 and the Citizens Alliance return, Holdings return as well. Absurd. You charge somebody with, especially when there is this additional requirement of willfulness, violating known legal duties. There's no evidence he even saw the return, let alone studied it or reviewed it with anybody. Which gets me now to the next phase of this, which is the Senate. And this is extraordinary. He is charged, as you know, in the first 64 counts of this indictment with fraud on the Senate, the institution that he has served for 30 years. Ed Rendell, he's always on. He never stops. Chris Craig, he could be a senator in Florida, in New England, wherever he is, he's a senator. He's always on. The government puts a summary chart up. We want to show you all the days that this man is outside of Philadelphia and Harrisburg to let you know that he's really not doing the people's business. And people talk about hearing from him. Well, when he's away, it's worse. He's more obsessive. He's on top of everything. You know, message to Garcia notwithstanding. He wants to be decision-making. He wants to do these things, and he's involved. Ed Rendell. I hear from him even when he's in Florida or Martha's Vineyard. You can be a senator in any of these places. But they put that summary chart up there for some reason about, you know, he's not really doing the people's business out there. Now, if he had decided to go to the Senate and just, as he said, the only obligation is to show up and vote and you don't even have to do that, none of this would have happened. If he decided to be treated as royalty, as he says in that email to Dottie, and, you know, just go there and show up, if that's all he and this incredible staff did, there'd be no case, right? He didn't choose to do that. Remember Podgorski, the tech who said he worked 50 to 60 hours a week? Not like Don Wilson, who just like, he's the guy who waits for the call to come in, and he looks on, what is it, QVC or eBay, I don't know what you call it, and he doesn't really knock himself out all that much. But you can make of a job what you want to make of a job. But Gorsi talks about 50 to 60 hours a week, just like Luchko's a workaholic, and just like, you know, some of these other techs that you've heard about work hard. But what happens is that they have this idea that with people working for Senator Fumo, that somehow this is just normal stuff. Remember Podgorski said, now that I don't work for him and I work for all the other Democrats in the caucus in the immediate area, goes to the offices. It's nothing like Tasker Street. The phones hardly ring. This is different. This is bigger. He put together, when he went to the Senate 30 years ago, a plan that was different than anything anybody had conceived of as far as he was concerned. He said to you in his testimony when my client was on the stand, he said to you, when I started out, I wanted to do these big things, and I wanted to do special things. And what I did was, it sounds revolutionary today with modern technology, with blackberries and blueberries and redberries. They got everything today. You can be in touch with people anywhere on the face of the globe within minutes. But when we started out, we did something revolutionary. At the time, we got an answering service. And the answering service would, you know, have pagers to get us on the phone 2, 3 o'clock in the morning when a constituent had a problem. And you might say, isn't this a wonderful thing? Well, it's part of how he's developing his reputation in his district. It's a way for him to show the constituents that they should continue to support him. It's what representative government is all about and what it's supposed to be about. If he had been a senator who had stopped at even that, we wouldn't be here. But he didn't. He had grand ideas. Now, two times in the last 2 weeks, something happened in this case which really drew my attention. A lot of things drew my attention, but really drew my attention. Remember, it's the Senate of Pennsylvania that is the alleged victim on the first 64 counts. This is a very important point that I want to make. This is not a fraud against the public as the victim. The public is not named. It's the Senate institution. Okay? And keeping that in mind, the government then changes the focus. Mr. P says when he has my client on the stand, well, when the government took that server in Harrisburg, you went out and spent $50,000 more for another server, which is going to appeal to all of us as taxpayers, right? It's a waste of taxpayers' money. Well, maybe. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. But that's not a fraud. There's no deception about that, right? The chief clerk knows the Senate's getting billed for a new server after the other server has been taken by the government and then returned. No fraud, but it appeals on a certain level that look how the public, taxpayers' dollars, is being spent. Waste of taxpayer dollars. Legitimate conversation to have here or anywhere else if, in fact, that was the real issue in this case. I mean, we can have discussions. Should the governor have his own mansion paid for by the tax? Any of these things. We can have these discussions all the time. Heads of states having their own airplanes. Doesn't matter. We can have these discussions. The President of the United States need Air Force One as opposed to Air Force Two. We can always have these discussions. But if you're going to say that it's a waste of taxpayer dollars, which doesn't translate to a fraud on the Senate, which is what he's charged with, how the government chose to charge him in this case, then let's not have a one-sided conversation. Let's not leave it at that. Let the jury, like the taxpayers, decide what is a worthwhile expenditure of taxpayer dollars with respect to a man who gets his own budget, his appropriations chair, to run both his Philadelphia and his appropriations committee offices in Harrisburg. And given, as you're going to see in a few minutes, you remember the story from Faber, almost unlimited discretion about what he can do with the money, with his own budget. Okay? So if you're going to decide in the context of an argument like the one Mr. Zosmer made when he said the Seaport Museum got $2 million in Delaware River Port Authority money, your tolls when you go over the bridge. Again, no fraud. Everybody knows Port Authority sends over that money to the Seaport Museum. So let's have a full conversation about it so that we would have balance, so that we would have a discussion about this. That is, in getting that budget to do the things that he did, is it a worthwhile expenditure to give him that specific budget that he had? Don't cut off the conversation when people like the governor of Pennsylvania get up there and say he never stops, he's always on, he works, he's like me when it comes to this stuff. Or when Ken Snyder gets up and starts rattling off all the things that he did for this region, for the city, for the state. When he talks about $8 billion in economic and community development that he did here, let's find out what that's all about so you can make a judgment as to whether or not that budget he got is a worthwhile expenditure of taxpayer dollars. Don't stop at that door if you're going to make the arguments that they've made. Let's find out how many jobs were saved, how many businesses came. Let's find out how many CEOs wanted to move to Philadelphia, as he said, and bring their businesses here because of the cultural developments that he did. You heard my client's testimony.
Objection, Your Honor. Objection to this line of argument, Your Honor.
This was testimony in the case. Testimony in this case.
Not Mr. Kogan, I'm going to overrule the objection.
Thank you. So, you get my point. That's not the discussion that the government wanted to have in this courtroom. So, what we find out is that the government alleges in this case that we're here because of his use of staff impermissibly and Senate resources like, loaned computers out to people. This is the fraud in this case. That's what the government of the United States says in this courtroom. Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, again, if he decided not to do the things he did, if they decided not to build Jefferson Square with 91 homes for low and moderate income people, if he decided not to do Passyunk Avenue revitalization and do the things that he did, if he decided not to do all the things that he did through the Citizens Alliance money and all those other things he did, and he was that senator who showed up occasionally to vote, and that's it. He wouldn't be here, right? So it is the Senate entity that is the victim. And what is the money or property that he sought to get or obtain? Remember, fraud, that is someone who, through devises a scheme to defraud by obtaining money or property. So what is it? It is the personnel, mostly, that did things for him of a personal or political nature. And that's most of what we're talking about here. And I want to get into the rest of it in a few minutes. Well, first of all,
People, personnel, are not property. Okay? We resolved that issue about people being property in this country a long time ago. What people do on their own time is their business. You want to get involved in a political campaign on your own time, you can. You want to get involved in doing things for each other at the workplace or for yourself on your own time or for your boss because you're loyal to him and he's a member of your extended family, you can. What is it that he obtained? Says the government, the use of personnel, in large measure for the Senate frauds, on compensated Senate time. And we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. So what are the rules that apply here? Isn't that the first place you start? What are the rules that apply? What are the rules that are being circumvented? What are the rules that are being, treated in a way, how can we get a device or a scheme to materially misrepresent something to the Senate of Pennsylvania so that I can get all of this? These are the rules. First witness in the case, if my recollection is right, if I'm wrong, just tell me I'm wrong, was Russell Faber. Faber is the chief clerk of the Senate. Russell Faber testifies in response to my questions as follows. Mr. Faber, there are various publications of the Senate that you look to in order for you to do your job. That's right. And you have the financial operating rules. You've got, the policies on the Committee of Management Operations. You've got the Senate leave policy. You also have the resolutions of the Senate, those things that become law by being passed on the floor of the Senate, those things that have the force and effect of law. Yeah, look at all those things. Do any of those publications specifically tell you what is a proper expenditure of Senate resources as it relates to Senate employees or contractors? Answer, no. Well, my approach, he says, Faber, is anything that serves a legislative purpose. I ask, can you tell us where is it defined what a legislative purpose is? It's undefined. Well, it's undefined. Yeah. The unwritten rule. I want to underline the unwritten rule. Back in law school, we used to say the unwritten rule is not worth the paper it's not written on. The unwritten rule is that a proper legislative purpose is anything that furthers the duties and the responsibilities of the Senate member, be it in policy, in the development of legislation, or constituent services. That's a proper legislative purpose. All undefined. I say to him, why so loosey-goosey? Remember that question? Why so loosey-goosey? Why aren't there rules about how you use employees, what you can spend money on? Are we going to always look to the Ethics Commission to give us an interpretation about that? And what did he say? You'll have to ask the senators. They make policy. They're the policymakers. They are the representatives of the Senate body. They are the Senate institution. So? Ask the senators. Did the government call one senator, past or present, Republican or Democrat, friend or foe of Vincent Fumo, ever in the course of this trial, to find out what their expectations were, what they considered to be an appropriate expenditure of Senate funds as it relates to personnel? Not one. One senator to come in and tell us whether he operated in any way that was outside of what is accepted practices. One senator to say whether they approached the pay management plan any differently than he did as a tool, an advisory. One senator who will come in here and say that they do things differently with respect to political campaigns and the like. You remember Paul Dugalecki was on the stand? He said, this goes on in the Senate. They said, name one. And he said, I don't want to do that. And then the judge said, you got to answer the question. I can't, meaning I'm not going to do it. One senator, past or present, Republican or Democrat, independent, someone who loves this guy, hates this guy, anybody. And Faber says, don't ask me, ask them.
a fraud against the Senate. That's what we're charged with here. And they don't call one. Well, what about you, Mr. Faber? What do? If you think something is wrong? Have you ever investigated any of the other Senate offices now or in the past? No. You don't know what they're doing? No. What would you do if you found something you thought was wrong? I would probably quietly go over and talk to the Senate member, he said, or if that didn't work, go to the minority leader for the Democrats and majority leader for the Republicans. Well, here we are in late 2008. My client is still in the dwindling days of 2008 as this trial is going on, a member of the Senate. You say, Mr. Faber, that you read the indictment in this case. Is that right? You saw the allegations. You say that if you ever heard anything or saw anything that you thought was wrong in any way, you would approach the person. You'd talk to the person. If that didn't work, you'd go to the leader. Did you do that in this case in a year and a half? The indictment was returned in February 2007. No. A fraud against the Senate institution. So what is the fraud, says the government? Senate, we're going to tell you how you've been victimized. I mean, how do you victimize a victim who, on its own, leaves almost everything by design to the discretion of the Senate member? Where he assigns people, don't have to be in the office. At the grand jury, remember I asked Mr. Faber this, you were told that Pat Freeland doesn't go to Tasker Street. She works out of this 501c3. Yeah, that's right. If Ruth Arneo is working out of, you know, doing Citizens Alliance work, a 501c3, to do the constituent service work that you say is a legislative purpose because it furthers the duties and responsibilities of the senator, you know, to do constituent service work, and they're doing it on a grand scale with Ruth Arneo and Jamie Spagna doing this kind of stuff, well, that may be an Ethics Act violation. In what way would it be an Ethics Act violation? Why you had no problem with Pat Freeland? Now you're bringing this up. Mr. Faber, you yourself, don't you run a 501c3 golf tournament out of your own office? Well, you know, don't call a senator, not a single one. But, says the government, here's how you were victimized, victim. You were victimized this way. You were victimized because people who were staffers were doing things for him on what we call compensated Senate time. And as you know, since the senator has maximum flexibility as to when during the day the 37 hours gets done, compensated Senate time would be anything that cuts into the 37 and a half hour work week, essentially. And it's not going to be a fraud if you got somebody who's missing an hour or two or something like that. Obviously. So now, that's the first thing. Second thing is, contractors, the government says, who were doing things for him and being paid but not doing Senate work. That's the second part of this, right? And the third is this thing about computers and people using computers on a loan. And my client's a big mistake about the Dottie Agri, but we get it back. They're loans. They're not gifts over to these people. So, the first exercise, then, in the case with respect to Senate staffers is, are these people really putting in the time that they say, or is somehow the Senate being defrauded because they're not, because they're doing all these personal things for him? So now, what's this exercise that we go through for months in this courtroom? You're probably saying, what the heck are these lawyers up to? They're doing math with these people. That's the case that they bring us, the 37 and a half hour work week requirement. They put a summary chart up the other day of theft by Senator Fumo after saying how much they were impressed when they had Dugalecki on the stand about how hard the budget people worked in Harrisburg. You remember that? They put down that he stole $37,000 because Jerry Sable in 2003 worked on the farm. Okay? And you heard what Sable said, you know, 4 hours a week, whatever it was for a few months. Whatever the number was, consider. Just try this. I can't wrap my little brain around this, but let me see if I can make sense of this.
I had it on here, and it would probably take too long to find it. But, and it'd take too long to find it. Mr. Sabin, because you worked for my client, because you were drawn to my client, you worked on his budget for his appropriations committee. That's right. You work 50 to 60 hours a week. Yes, he says, and you give up a lot. You realize how much time you lose from your family when you do that stuff, and it really took its toll. Just like Sandy Leopold came in and said, I was 67, I had to stop. It's too much. He gives the Senate of Pennsylvania 50 to 60 hours a week, and I did some math because I got a tutorial from Jacobs that night about how to do math. And he does 50 to 60 hours a week when he's only required to put in 37 and a half hours a week. So do we give Fumo a credit surplus for that? Do we take all these people like Jerry Sable, Sandy Leopold, Jennifer Boger, Paul Dulek, Sue Sweat, all the people who are putting in these extraordinary hours according to all the testimony in this case, you know, Chris Craig, for heaven's sake, all they have to do is work 37 and a half hours a week. How many millions and millions and millions of credit surplus dollars should go into his column if we did it that way? But Jerry Sable, the Senate is victimized, the victim, the Senate, because at the end of his career, he's never going to get compensated for the overtime. There's no overtime pay. There's no bonus arrangement there in his office. This is not part of your sick leave or your vacation leave or anything like that. This is, what, 60, 20, let's really be extravagant, 30 hours that he put into the, because he wanted to do it. He wanted to do it. Is there any doubt about that? He wanted to do it. And we did the math. That means if I'm really conservative, you work 50 hours a week, not the 60 hours a week, but on average a week, doing Senate work all those years, when all you had to do was 37 and a half hours. And if you and if you do that, 50, minus 37, you're getting like 12 and a half hours. You're doing more than you should each and every week. That's right. So the Senate would, at the end of your career, even being real conservative, they'd owe you about 10,500 or 600 hours if we subtracted out the farm thing you wanted to do. He doesn't get credit for drawing people in his orbit to work and break their necks doing it for him. Why? You heard what they say. John Raymond. How did you put up with it all those years? We know that he knows more than we do. Jennifer Boger. Why would you work 50 to 60 hours a week? Working for Senator Vincent Fumo made it all seem tolerable. Vince Rossi, the Republican, the outsider in the group, the former priest. I liked working for Vincent Fumo. He gets things done. We don't get credit for that. They're playing the math game. They're compressing the 37 and a half hours. And let's look at this. This is absolutely extraordinary. Government Exhibit 435. I mean, I know I have no life if I can remember these exhibits. Numbers. This is crazy. 435. This is when Jerry complains to Vince that Paul took him off the farm project, okay? And what he says is, and I see some smiles, you know how this goes. Paul, Senator, he's complaining about Paul. I've been pulled off the farm project by Paul. Apparently he has no one to write the appropriations questions for the hearing. When am I out of the office working on the farm stuff? I got constant BlackBerry emails, et cetera. He goes on and on. He's complaining. And what does my client say? A guy who's not standing at the guard post, you know, checking, because the Senate has no rules about, you know, keeping hours or even for contractors specifying their time. This isn't the victim, the Senate. This is their absence of rules. They don't punch cards. My client says, this is the fraud, okay? This is part of the fraud. Can you, Jerry, I'm disappointed in all of this. Your duties to the committee come absolutely first and foremost, capital letters. I only asked you to help with the farm because I thought it was something that you might enjoy doing on your own time. But I cannot and will not pay you
with taxpayer money to do work on the farm. So please give me a memo of who you have contacted on stuff regarding that, and I will take over the project. This must have been a plan. Because if you see something like this, and you understand his management approach, that, yeah, I really should not have emails where I say, do this, do that. I should say, please do me a favor if you want. And if you don't want to do it, there will be no repercussions. Would that change this case? Well, this changes this case, doesn't it? You see what the approach is. I am really disappointed. Your Senate work comes first. I expected you to do this on your own time. And what's he say? Up to the top. Please, Mr. Shapiro, if you will. Go to the top. Okay. He says, these people are only available during the day, and that is when I have been seeing them. When I can use a telephone, I do. The Ag Extension people are only available during regular working hours. The committee stuff is no big deal, but I do have to be out here occasionally meeting with people to get the farm stuff done. There is no way around that. And he goes on to say, it's a big undertaking. If I have some cooperation, I can meet my obligation to the committee and get the farm stuff done. When I retire, which is about to happen, right? When I retire, the committee stuff will no longer be an issue, so I'll do my best to juggle everything in the meantime. And he talks about, you know, I'm, you know, not like any schmuck, you know, does that. And he says, and here's what he says, I did not mean to press your buttons, because he knows how my client's reacting to this. A suggestion that people are not putting in their time, he says, this is Jerry, you know, this is not somebody who the government's going to say is offended by my client's emailing. Let's kiss and make up. I need warm feelings carrying me into the weekend. Take care. And then what happens is he comes back and he does these silly budget questions that he thinks at the end of his career, trying to make others on the Appropriations Committee who don't know what my client knows, you know, look smart on, you know, that great, widely seen, you know, closed-circuit TV thing that they have where they televise, as the judge said. That really has a high rating, doesn't it? You know, the budget hearings of the Pennsylvania Senate, people really look in on that all the time. And Sable chuckled. Amazing. Government Exhibit 4, and he comes back and he does the budget questions anyway. And he's putting in the course of a career, that week he didn't put in 37 and a half hours. We forget all the stuff that he did all those years for what? Was it 20-some years? Fraud on the Senate? They have it on their chart. His theft of $30-some thousand because half the wages, I don't know where they come up with this, for the year, even though Sable says it's nothing like that time, half the wages of Sable for the half a year that he would be working. Because he retires in June or July, if I remember, something like that. You know, I can go over every single one of these people, and I want to go through it rather quickly. But here's what you have in terms of this case. Before you get to the pay management plan, which is worthy of talking about very soon. Ruth Arneo, despite all the stuff that she's doing through Citizens Alliance, $245,000 because her job classification is not right on. Howard Kane, $402,750, which is 75% of 1999 to 2006. That's the fraud. We're going to talk about Howard Kane soon. Lisa Costello, I love this, $12,000. 20% of 2000 to 2002. Let's talk about Lisa Costello. Lisa Costello has a housekeeping business, and she comes over during this period of time, and they put it from 2000 to 2002, where she's doing housekeeping, and it may be in the morning or the afternoon, okay? A few hours, maybe 1 or 2 hours, days a week, depending. A half a day, maybe. Maybe a day. My client calls her Miss Passyunk Avenue, constituent service worker. Government present a single bit of evidence that this woman is not doing her 37 and a half hours a week, doing it in the morning, an hour a day in the morning early, so she can get 5 hours of housekeeping in during the day. Do they do anything like that? Nothing. Just assume it away that she's not doing 37 and a half hours a week without any evidence. We take the hit for that as well. You can go down the list. Lillian Cazzo? The government has been defrauded by Lillian Cazzo. You heard that woman, a woman who was, in the early days, she used to sleep with a pad and pencil next to her nightstand, on her nightstand, because this guy, this nut, would call on the phone about do this and do that late at night. It's her job classification that's the issue.
They introduce an exhibit. You don't have to go to it, Mr. Shapiro. A summary of emails of all the things Lillian Cazzo did over a six-year period. There are like 100 of them. Obviously, there are more than that. He asked her to make, you know, reservations, have Dottie picked up at the airport, you know, call the doctor, do all those things. 16 a year, according to the emails that we saw. Let's assume there are more, but that's their exhibit. Summary of Lillian Cazzo, personal things she's doing for the senator. Who is the fraud? Who's someone who's in part of this fraud? David Nelson, the driver, who's also doing these other things, this fraud, which the government sneers at. That's interesting. Everybody. Fraud? Everybody. Everybody knows that he has drivers. You might say he's an elitist. He shouldn't have drivers. And then, of course, we get into this whole question, what's he doing when he's in the car? Well, let's not get into that. That has nothing to do with this case. So what, he's doing all this stuff for, you know, the Commonwealth. No matter. What did Nelson say? The senator's like a brother. I work a double shift. He's there during the day. I'm waiting for him. Yeah, I pick up laundry at Sprague's house every week or two, whatever it is. But I'm out in the, at night with him, too, at community groups, civic associations. I'm out there with him. And you heard that he's corroborated by the governor when he says, I used to take him to, you know, to Rendell's house. You know, to meet with David Cohen and Rendell at midnight? This guy's out there doing that. That's his job. There is no classification for driver. Everybody knows he's a driver working for Senator Fumer. There's no secret here. There is no false representation anywhere. There is no device to defraud anybody here. There is no intent to defraud. You can go down this list, every single one of these witnesses that they talk about, every one of the people that you heard. Gina Novelli. All of her wages, you know, wages from 1999 to 2002, $95,000 worth of theft by him. She did not look like the Gina Novelli I knew, says Agent Humphreys, and then we come up with this email between her and Luchko when they're talking about how they've been treated, and she says, Gina Novelli says, you know, the government really tries to put words in your mouth. Charlie Shoulders. There's an interesting exercise, isn't it? Charlie Shoulders comes in here and testifies to you that he works, comes in early in the morning. Well, on session days, he stays late, and you heard the whole thing, and that he might cut out when the senator's not in town on the session days, like at 3:30 in the afternoon. The government says, no way. No way. He's living on the farm. He's living on the farm free of charge. His wife is getting paid to do the work, and no way that he's doing that. And then you hear from Justin Ferrante and Sue Saloff, who come in here and say, yeah, he's the first one in the morning. He's there at 7:30 in the morning. Paul says, the guy's putting in a day. The government says, didn't you say when we had you before the grand jury eventually 80% of your time during a certain period of time, 80% of what? He says, Shoulders, who had maintained repeatedly, he said, before the grand jury, but somehow they're throwing questions at him and a number comes out of the air. 80% of what? He's living on the farm 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. What does the 80% do? What's it relate to? You can go on and on with every single one of these people, and you see that they're putting in their required time, but more importantly, that the government proved beyond a reasonable doubt that they weren't. That's really the burden here. Coyne is an interesting example. Remember Coyne? Coyne is the guy who's working on the Casey campaign. He's not being forced to work on the Casey campaign. He supports Casey. His father worked for the elder Casey when the elder Casey was alive and was governor of Pennsylvania. He's putting in during that campaign for like 10, you know, months or so. He's putting in a good, you know, anywhere from 10 to 20 hours a week. But he also says something else when he's questioned. He says, in response again to Jacob's questions, you would sneer at the idea of somebody working a 37 and a half hour a week, wouldn't you? Yeah, I would. This is a 24-7 job. Over time, I'm working 50 to 60 hours a week. Can he say on every single week during the period of time he's doing Casey work that he's doing all that? I can go on with every single one of these witnesses, but you heard the evidence. Each and every one of these staffers, Jamie Spagg works 50 hours a week. Most honest witness in the world, the government says, when she gets on the stand. She honestly comes in here until you get to the part where she said, I did all that other stuff, Fumo for Senate and the other stuff, on my own time. I'm putting in 50 hours a week. And that includes doing constituent service work through Citizens Alliance and being out in the evening with the senator at civic associations and meetings like that. Did the Senate get its fair share from her? Let's turn
then says the government to the one person who's going to come in here and let you know that he's really not working anything close to 37 and a half hours a week. The government calls Christian Marone to the stand. Christian Marone, the son-in-law. Now, remember what Christian Marone said. Christian Marone says that he comes to work as a full-time staffer after he had been an intern for Vince Fumo. He comes to work in May of 1997. He says for the first 18 months, he is assigned to work as a full-time project manager on Green Street. Forced to do it. And he's putting in on balance, he says, 80% of his time on Green Street. That's what he says. Well, what we did was, just so that this is very clear, so that this chronology doesn't get messed up, because it can. So from May 1997 to December 1998, this is the period of time when he's not giving the Senate its due. After that, he says, where the Green Street stuff was negligible, because most of it was done, from after that period, he's putting in maybe 10% on Green Street. That's what he says. Now, we know he's working 7:30 to 5:30 every day, 10 hours a day. That's 50 hours a week after December 98 by his own testimony. So if you take 10% for Green Street, he's given the Senate about 45 hours a week, even if you don't include weekends and stuff like that. Fair? That's what we're talking about. So now the government says, let's take a look at what he was doing. And you saw those emails, leaks, 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 barking dog, barking dog, barking dog. You know, electrical guy, electrical guy, electrical guy. That's what you hear. And, of course, he throws in at the end just because, you know, it might help. Oh, by the way, one day he told me to throw some poison over the fence at the barking dog. You ever tell the government that before? Yeah, I told them that last month. After meeting with the government in 2004, 2005, 2006, testifying before a grand jury. So let's focus on what it is he is saying and how this all falls apart in time. The government presents that exhibit and the summary of Green Street projects, Mr. Shapiro, which is... Is it 261? Barking dog, carpentry work, electrical work, elevator, fireplace, flooring, all this stuff. So what we do is we prepare our own chart for you, and it doesn't come up too well on the computer screen. So what we did was we did a blow-up, and the way we listed it, and the way we blew it up, we had to do it on three of these charts. Now you will see that when you open these things up, barking dog, you know, carpentry work, electrical work, elevator, all this stuff, all of this takes place during the period of time when he's given the Senate more than 37 and a half hours a week, because that, and you'll find the testimony actually, October 29th, the way he gets pages 34 to 36, where he says clearly he is putting in, you know, more than enough time. This is 10% of his time. And all of this, every single one of these things, occur during the period of time when he is, all the emails that you saw, okay? Every one of those things occurs. And the Senate, it's not on compensated Senate time, because in fact what's taking place is he's working more than 37 and a half hours a week. So what? And we see all the stuff that he's doing. You will not doubt this at all. You will not doubt the fact that this guy is working hard. He's doing a lot of things. And we know this when we even look at what happens in, after 2000, he says he learns from Sue Sweat you can actually get paid reimbursements for certain expenses when you leave the office, you know, like parking and stuff like that. He first learns that in 2000. And so what he does is he puts together vouchers for his time, you know, where expenses are incurred. And you saw them. I went through that exercise. So you could see the breadth and the scope of what just one staffer does for Vincent Fumo during that period of time.
And it's just staggering the projects that are going on in this office. But let's take, for example, 402.1. And instead of going through every single one of these vouchers to just, you know, scope out for you how much time this man is putting in during the period of time, even when he's fielding questions about Green Street, this is given in November, submitted to Sue in November 2001, and this covers the months of September and October, and these are just for expenses outside the office. This is not the universe of stuff he's doing. And here's what he's doing. You know, and I'm just going to skip through it. You know, it's parking for a meeting with Judge McCaffrey regarding prisons, a meeting with the board president of the Independence Charter, Jay Borowski, and board member Herb Wolfson, meeting with Wayne Kimmel of Eastern Technology Council to discuss several issues relating to technology companies in Philadelphia, parking for Chamber of Commerce meeting, parking for meeting with Obermeyer firm to discuss several issues related to Senator Fumo. Transportation, scroll down. Meeting with Keith Ellison of Ellison Group to discuss business seminar program for district. Meeting with Dennis Toner of the United of Senator Biden. Whatever happened to him? Senator Biden's staff to discuss several issues pertaining to Philadelphia and Senator Fumo. Parking for a community court meeting. And you can go on, and it's just staggering what this one staffer is doing. Chamber of Commerce breakfast, community court, again, Philadelphia Police Department meeting with somebody in the Philadelphia Police Department regarding several pieces of legislation, parking to discuss, you know, stuff regarding the Athena Education Group. I mean, you can go on to use someone's terms. You can't make this up. You can't make this up. This is just one staffer who's doing 10% of his time during a 50-hour work week for a guy who's about to become his father-in-law when things are better, okay, between the family members. And this shows the scope and breadth of things that he's doing, even as he's doing this stuff. But no, he says, even though I had nothing to turn over to the government regarding 97 and 98, I gave them all the records I had. Okay? Trust me, 80% of my time is on Green Street. So I'm not putting in my time. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because we now know what happens. We now know what happens. We know that even when he's doing his desk audit in 2001, which is 628, this is now 2001, before we get to 97, 98, if you go to that 628, which is his own desk audit, these are the things that he's doing. 100% for the senator, which includes the following projects: Green Street, Independence Charter School, 201 Spring Garden Street, that's the incubator. Planning, marketing, technology, assisting Philadelphia Technology Alliance with funding and marketing, working with Eastern Technology Council on several issues, including a regional marketing plan, community court, student retention, working on the student retention committee, Passyunk Avenue revitalization project, public safety, police and public safety, preparing legislation with Harrisburg, preparing legislation and police wish list for Senator Stack, Auto Insurance Reduction Task Force, and on and on and on and on, filling in for Gary Toom as a spokesman when he's not there, working with cluster leader and school district, plan reorganization. This is the most interesting part. Over the past several years, can you blow this up? Over the past several years, I have asked the senator to become more involved in more substantive issues such as campaigns, and some of the larger and more important issues and projects. I would welcome such an opportunity and would gladly take on the extra work. In other words, he's not getting the political campaign stuff back then. Okay? He wants it. He wants to take on more. In addition, I'd like to put my legal education to work for the center. In my conversations with Chris Craig, he needs help. And then he says this: I would also gladly accept more of a leadership role in the office if truly allowed to do so. My education and proven ability to get things done could be utilized more effectively. He's not even one of the leaders in the office. And this is what he's doing, all the things that he's doing, to give you some sense of the scope and the breadth of the activities that are going on in this office, the Senate office, that's defrauding the Senate institution of Pennsylvania. So now what happens? And if this doesn't get interesting, and if this is not mind-boggling, then, well, it's your decision to make. He says that he gave them all the records he had, all the records that showed the various things that I just said. But what he doesn't do is have anything to give them for 97 and 98, because he didn't do anything, really. Mr. Marone, you knew when the new defense came in, the new team, we started subpoenaing documents from schools that you applied to see what you were saying you were doing back in 97 and 98. I know that. I mean, we made a beeline to resumes and things like, Mr. Zod, it's a stunt. Defense lawyers are stunned. They had this all along. They didn't have anything all along at all. Not until we started to dig. Stuff the government never turned over. What happens is this. We send a process server out because we want to make sure that we're going to cover every base. You know, like sending, you know, finding out what he's got at his house to show what, in fact, he's done during May of 97 to December of 98 when he says he's doing nothing. Really, he's doing some police work and stuff like that. He later says to the government, he's doing nothing. He's 80% of his time. He's like a no-show guy, is what he's saying. P.J. Harrison says, you know, he's the pop in and out, maybe an hour a week, an hour a day, excuse me, one or two times a day, but an hour at the most. And he was a nasty sort of guy. He didn't like him. P.J. did. But he would come in, he'd pop in and out, usually in the morning or the afternoon. That was it, which would be consistent. You know, with the guy still putting in all that time. And PJ's there as of 97, if you remember. Rita Jensen's there in September of 98. I saw him about three times, she said. She's there September 98, still when he's putting in 80% of his time, according to him. So what do? We send the process server out. I show the picture. Mr. Marone, be careful here. Didn't you have a process, or someone you knew was a process server out of your house? You see this picture? Oh, that guy, he looked like a hoodlum. This guy played offensive line for Penn State. Scared to death of Brian Huntley. This is what they're handing you. Stunt. I'm putting over a stunt on you. This guy says, I never opened the door. I was shaking in my boots. He scared my kids half to death. Sosberg points at Vince and says, how dare he scare his grandchildren to death? That he sent somebody out knocking on the door of a house where inside is, you know, Joe Paterno's protege, if you believe him, okay? Offensive lineman for Penn State, scared to death. So I never opened the door. I don't even know who that was. I never opened the door. I looked through a window, and what did I see? I could see this guy came from a basketball court. That's interesting. Yeah, he was wearing black basketball sneakers. You saw that from the window? Is that what you did? Hunley takes the stand. The other guy takes the stand. How much are they paying you to come in here with your affidavit saying you went there and the guy opened the door and said Christian Marone doesn't live here? Stunt? Just like Kogan said in his opening that it was a fundraiser's fee and he checked his, he changed it during the course of this trial when it came to Citizens Alliance. Whose stunt is this in the first place? So now what happens? This is priceless. What he says is, just at that moment, shortly before trial, I've been down there since 2004, 2005, 2006, testified before a grand jury. I have no other records. I can't find it. My wife happened to find this old computer, and I put everything on a disk that we had, and I sent it over to the government. I just didn't know I had it. Well, okay. What do we find? What do we find? Here's what we find. Mr. Zosman says, you're going to find there's absolutely nothing in there. I mean, just, you know, 12 or 14 or 20 or whatever it is, emails or memos. Here's what you find. These are just the things I asked him about, if you remember. I'm going to read to you how this went down during the testimony. D6, boot and toe legislation, June 26, 1997. All of a sudden, he's turning over something he did in 97. Crime mapping, December 1997. Obtaining helicopters, June 98. Patrol bikes, September 19th, 97. I have nothing from 97, 98, he tells the government. All of a sudden, this stuntster over here makes him come up with a hard drive, and he's got a D-35, November of 98, House Bill 433, 24.1, April 21st, 98, police hiring practices, D-34, more police hiring practices, D-20, October 30th, 1997. When he's doing none of this stuff, remember. He has no paperwork. Police information technology is what he's doing. September 97. Rethinking the Philadelphia Police Department. Mr. Zosmer says anybody could look that up. My college professor said, you know, you could always tell a phony when you look at a cover and it announces something that anybody could have found in the Daily News. Why didn't he hand that over to the government? When he's taking the position with the government that he's a no-show employee, essentially, from May 97 to December 1998. All of these come forward now. The government says the Senate is being victimized because with respect to that staffer, he's not doing compensated Senate time. Bratton's Police Department, it's nothing compensated. Nothing, the government says. Chop Shop Tip Line, February of 98. The LoJack program, D-37.1, during this period of time. Set the bus routes. Tax, as early as September of 97, set the bus routes work. October 14, 97, tax on lottery winnings, where he's telling businesses they can't really charge an extra tax if a lottery ticket is bought in the city of Philadelphia to get said city revenues. D-12, September 17, 97, VA health systems. And then D-10, the government says, this is not much, October 22nd, 1997, something about zoning. And then, if you remember how this really went, because I had this guy on the witness stand for a day and a half. And, you know, when I reach the point where I can no longer see the whites of your eyes, I know it's time to stop. Okay? So I stop, and here's what I say. I could go on and on, I say. And I say to him, Mr. Marone, on page 120, I'm not going to go through each of these exhibits that have been pre-marked, the ones that are left, but let me just ask you a few questions. And then I end by saying to him, all right, I think I'm not going to get into these others. I mean, you saw the stack. I'm not going to get into these others. Oh, all they have is 20. That's all they have. But what else? What else? You see, there are other things, too, that reveal him for the person he really is. We have 322.3. which is a resume that is prepared showing the things that he's doing, projects that he was involved in from 97 to the present, and we were able to show him from the directory that we showed him that this was from 2001, from 97 to 2001. He goes over all these things that he's involved in. I'm not going to read them. Property projects, economic development projects. Scroll down. Public safety projects. You know, all these things that I just mentioned, the LoJack program, all these things. Education assisted in the creation of the Christopher Columbus Charter School, which is located in South Philly. Currently assisting in the creation and construction of the Independence Charter School, located in Society Hill, and the Russell Byers Charter School, which is located in the Spring Garden section. It gets even more interesting. What else do we discover? And because I don't want to get dizzy looking at the computer screen, let me get the hard copy. This is 322.2. This is what he's doing between 97 and 98. Now, here's what he says. First of all, in 322.2, defense exhibit, which was admitted into evidence, here's something that I didn't even review with you
early on. This is the Harvard application. Do you remember when you go to Harvard, young man? Look at the application as Mr. Shapiro has it on page one, the first paragraph. Describe your career to date, positions, and dates. This is an application. He says, in my last year of Penn State, at the bottom of the first paragraph, I worked for the Pennsylvania State Senate Appropriations Committee, January of 97 to May 97. That's accurate. From this position, State Senator Vincent J. Fumo, Appropriations Chairman, promoted me to legislative assistant after my graduation, May 97 to January 98. In January 1998, I'm going to say it one more time so it's clear. In January 1998, you know, during the period of time when he's doing, you know, 80% Green Street, he says, the senator promoted me again to the position of Director of Economic Development and Local Government Affairs. That's what he's doing in January of 98. Well, is this like Sprague? Well, I just, you know, tell Harvard whatever I want to tell. Sprague, you know, I tell, you know, the House Committee, the United States Congress, whatever I want to tell them. But what about this? Page, you remember this, when he was on the stand. That was a fun exercise, wasn't it? Two. You see it on the screen. Describe your most substantial professional challenge and achievement and explain why you view it as such. And this is amazing. In 1997, good year, right? In 1997, the Philadelphia Police Department had a 14% drop in crime. He goes on to say, countless polls showed middle-class residents fleeing the city compared to other big cities such as New York and Boston, where crime was drastically decreased. Philadelphia's improvement was minimal. Yet despite these obvious facts, many public officials shied away from the department's meager success. After investigating and researching the department, the guy who my client, I'm interrupting now, said that a top-to-bottom study of the Philadelphia Police Department for him in 97 and 98. He says, after investigating and researching the department, I found a police force that was underfunded and poorly managed. I guess he read it in the Daily News somewhere. Most importantly, the department lacked leadership and direction from the commissioner and commanding officers, which resulted in low morale and unfair treatment. Next page. By pressuring both Senator Fumo and Mayor Rendell to act, John Timoney was hired to head the department. This is all that he's doing in 97. Timoney, you remember, was hired in March 98. He did all this leading up to pressuring Fumo to bring in John Timoney, who became that terrific police commissioner we had in Philadelphia. What was he doing this? When he was checking out the leaks? Yeah, he's doing Green Street. And why is he doing Green Street? I won't get the transcript out. It's there. You may remember it. You were ambitious. Isn't that right? Yeah. You wanted to be involved in everything the senator was involved in. Isn't that right? Yes. But he did Senate work from the day he came. And for reasons that only, you know, Mr. Stunt would understand. We have to go and dig this out ourselves to show exactly what that guy is all about. That's Marone. Now, it gets even better. The time has stopped for a while. My throat is ready to go.
It gets even better with Marone?
No, I'm not quite finished with him.
Oh, well, let's try to finish with him if you can.
Okay. All right, well, I'll do my best. Here's what happens. It's September 2000, there is a problem. Marone is having a power struggle with her. Now, how dare you allow this lady to run Citizens Alliance? Now, that doesn't come out in Marone's testimony on direct. Jacobs digs out, you know, a memo that he shows about the problems that they're having.
because Ruth had said something nasty about Marone's father. And this is what he was driving. He wanted to work out of the office on Green Street, he said, because there's no office on Green Street, his house. And that, he didn't want to even be around the office, because he didn't want to be around her. So what happens? What happens is that Marone, in September, that's right, we're experiencing technical difficulties for a second. Let me just get this. What happens is that Marone does this. He sends that test email out to my client. Do you remember? He said, I was just testing this guy. And what he says is that I send out an email saying, I think Citizens Alliance, you know, should professionalize its staff. It's not a knock at anybody. I'm not getting anybody. I think we should bring a professional team. I think we should rent out our services to other districts. We should do this. We should do that. I was testing him, says Marone. That's what I was doing. He says that I was gravely disappointed when the senator wrote back to me and said, yeah, but, you know, Citizens Alliance now is a smaller operation. You know, get bigger. It's going to have bigger requests. And quite frankly, all the political stuff we do around here, what's around here? Senate. Senate, Citizens Alliance. We'd have, you know how my guy talks. Someone else in our tent, to blackmail us or something like that. Aha, the smoking gun, says the governor. Well, really. Here's what happens. There is the testimony that I referred to. I referred him back to his grand jury testimony. This is September 2000, when he's so disappointed in Vincent Fumo. And I said, didn't you say this before the grand jury? And here's what he said. The guy who says that he was literally a ghost employee 4 years or 3 years earlier on Green Street, he says, as of the date of that email in September 2000, he says, up until that point, really, I mean, I idolized. Vince was a mentor to me. He was very helpful to me. He gave me a great job. I was working for somebody with a lot of influence coming out of college. He took the time to teach me kind of the ropes of politics and all that. I learned a great amount from him. He mentored me. He really pushed me to go to law school. He really cared about me, treated me like a son. And in turn, I trusted him that he would always do the right thing and that he wasn't doing anything illegal or unethical. Wait a minute. You've got a degree in political science before you go to work for him? You're a second-year law student? You think this guy's not doing anything illegal or unethical? As of September 2000, you're saying up to that point you didn't think so? Didn't you just tell us that you were a ghost employee in 97, 98? The guy who didn't show up with any records from that period of time when he went and spoke to the government? It's a stunt, isn't it? You know exactly what this guy is all about. Evil, 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 like the mafia. That's what he said on the witness stand, Christian Marone. That's Christian Marone.
You ready?
I really am over ready.
Okay, you need a break. We'll take a break. Please be seated, everyone. Dennis, are you ready to continue?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm just exhausted, but I'll do the best I can.
Take a shot.
It's like cross-examination where you're talking nonstop, and so, it's exhausting for me to do this, but I have to do it, so I have to continue.
Yeah, well, if you get groggy, let me know.
If we could break just a little earlier, it would be helpful. Just a little bit.
Yeah, okay. Okay, bring jury. Please be seated, everybody. Be seated. All right, Mr. Kogan.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, you remember when Paul Dugalecki testified in this case, and you know who he is. And what Paul testified to was what Vince Fumo said about the pain management plan of the Committee on Management Operations, a plan, the latest one especially, I want to talk about, that's the last one you saw. These plans were never adopted as resolutions on the floor of the Senate. No force and effect in law. What Paul said was that he would do the reclassifications, if you remember, and that what Vince would do would be that he would go over an Excel spreadsheet or something like that and make the designations as to who should get cost of living increase and things like that. And what Paul would do, both under the old plans and the new plan, is he would try to look for something that would describe in some way what the person is doing. And he said, as you heard in his testimony, that the pain management plans are a tool, as we see it. Now, this is a very peculiar situation because he's got his own budget, and he makes it clear to the senators, again, none of them are called, he makes it clear that he's not going to follow this plan inflexibly. Back under the old plan, he goes to some of those meetings. Those meetings are not called just for, you know, making nominations that various people be reclassified outside, you know, their classification or anything like that. What he does is he makes it clear that he can't inflexibly do this. He and the Republican counterpart have their own budgets. And what Paul says is that, so I do this. He doesn't. He's never seen one of these. Where his signature appears, it's my signature. Remember when the government had Paul on cross-examination, Mr. Zosmer started by saying, you're like the 51st senator, and you're probably happy that we, you know, everybody and all your budget guys, they're doing their jobs, working real hard. By the end of this case, Mr. Zosmer is calling him an unindicted co-conspirator because he makes it clear that what Senator Fumo says is the truth. There's no fraud here. What Paul does is he looks at this plan, Government Exhibit 102, and he views it as a tool. And here, if you go to the top, so we see what this is. This says, the Senate Pay Management Plan, this is the new one. The booklet contains the Pay Management Plan for employees of the Senate of Pennsylvania, which is adopted by the Committee on Management Operations on January 27, 2004. It is an important tool for senators to manage compensation costs, et cetera. Going on to the next highlighted area that Mr. Shapiro provided, these descriptions will be helpful in determining the proper classification for employees who change responsibilities or for new employees. So this is their approach, and they do this with sufficient transparency that they make it clear that they're doing what they can do given the limitations of the categories. And it gets better somewhat in 2004, 2005. But just to give you some sense that there is nothing close to what the government suggests
is a method and means by which a fraud can be perpetrated on the Senate of Pennsylvania. To make it clear, you don't see Driver anywhere, and everybody knows that he's got drivers. Everybody knows it. So remember, I told you I'd come back to the definition. One who has a scheme, devises a scheme, or participates in a scheme to defraud, to obtain money or property through fraudulent representations, pretenses, or promises, and that he acts with the intent to defraud. And Paul says, I'm the one who does it. Now he's, you know, not indicted co-conspirator, according to Mr. Zosmer's comment. He moved from the 51st senator, we're proud of, you know, the work you did over there, to this guy who's now the unindicted co-conspirator in the case, because he's carrying the water. He's saying, look, I'm doing the best I can. For example, okay, beat me up. Here's what I do. You get Mary Ann Cartullo. She does legislative support, we say. And the reason I put her in that category is, okay, you know, she's at the front line, when a constituent comes in and that percolates its way up to this. Right? Okay. The fact is, the government says people, this is a padded payroll, the government's saying. It's part of a scheme. For example, the government says, you have two chiefs of staff on Tasker Street. Well, yeah, everybody knows that. It's there in the classification form. The government says you don't need two chiefs of staff, but that's not a fraud. You're telling even the chief clerk, you're telling the world, I got two people who are doing it. What's wrong with it? Charlie Hoffman on the first floor is the chief of staff, running those great constituent workers, you know, service workers on the first floor that you don't hear anything about in this case. The government makes it clear that those people, you know, we know what's going on in that office. It's like the Taco Bell, people coming in and out all the time. And what's on the basement floor? What's on the basement floor is Roseanne, who's been with him all those years. Close to him, there's no question about it. She's the chief of staff, too. But what is she doing? What is Roseanne doing? Roseanne is a ward leader. And Sofrisi says, there's no seat, it's like ward headquarters. Committee people are coming downstairs. Now, committee people are constituents who have constituents. It's a big deal. And they're coming downstairs, and it's Roseanne, and Mary Ann Cortullo is her backup. And you hear that even for a period of time, Roseanne had another job, and she'd get into the office late in the morning from being a truant officer or something like that, and then she'd stay late at night, seeing all kinds of people, all manner of people, in connection with what's going on there. You get a committee person comes in, it's not, you know, for his or her own PennDOT thing. What's going on here, you can imagine, these people who are representing other people, you know, you have a zoning issue in a neighborhood, you got a bar that's serving minors or anything. This is part of the constituent service operation that's taking place. She's someone who works every weekend. Uncontradicted testimony in this case, because that's her life sitting over there, or was her life before this roof came in. That's what she's doing. She's providing those constituent services, and she's a chief of staff down there. And she's working. Sunday's her favorite day because it's quiet. So now what happens is this. In the summertime, remember, she's up to the point, she's been there so long, the Senate does this. They give long vacations to these people. You know, 5 weeks she's earned. So she goes down the shore when things are really slow anyway, and, you know, August, July, what do they say, the Jersey Shore is Philadelphia, in the summertime, or South Philly in the summertime. And what she does is she takes off between 4th of July and Labor Day. So she's putting in her 5 weeks. She's coming back every, you know, week or two for a couple days at a time. And she's in touch with the office anyway. And she's putting in all the time she's putting in, where she's the person who is there late at night every day during the week, during the regular year, and she's working weekends, and Lord knows what else is going on in terms of her staying in touch with the office. Okay. The government takes the position that there is some fraud that she is marked down as chief of staff, something that even Faber, knows about, and it's no secret. There is no fraud. Now, it's true. You look at the salary, you say, why should somebody make that kind of money? Ed Rendell said, I'd love to have some of these people who work for him. I'd love to get Chris Craig. I'd love to get Randy Albright. I'd love to get Paul Dugalecki
you know, the unindicted co-conspirator over here. I'd love to get him. But the Senate is different. You see, the executive branch of government's got lots of employees. I mean, it's a huge bureaucracy. To get somebody the salary that they get in the Senate, you need a statute passed, because everything is defined by statute. This is not the system in the Senate. Don't blame him. That's the system that the victim put in place according to the legislative code, that they get higher salaries there. So, you know, 5 weeks vacation, a lot of time. I haven't had 5 weeks vacation since, you know, the year before I became a paper boy serving papers for the Inquirer. I haven't had 5 weeks vacation. I don't know anything about what that's like. Neither do you, but that's what it is. That's not a fraud. That might be what we'd like to change one way or the other. We don't know. But the fact is, there's no secret about this. There's nothing that's being circumvented about that. There is no gaming going on here. There is no tricking going on here. There's no intent to knowingly act, with deceit or cheating. That's what a fraud is. They don't like it that people are getting salaries that they say are exaggerated because they are, according to the government's indictment, serving his needs and wants. That's how they wrote this indictment. Constantly serving his needs and wants, as though all the stuff that they're doing out of that Senate office, all this stuff they're doing out of these Senate offices in both Harrisburg and Philadelphia just happens to get done magically without people doing all these things. I know sometimes it is awfully hard to be fair. Sometimes it is awfully hard to start out saying, I will give someone the benefit of the presumption of innocence. I will not start out with preconceived notions about anything. I do not choose to take the position that the government is the home team and in the bottom half of the ninth inning, they get four outs rather than three. That's changing the games and the rule of changing the rules right smack in the middle of the game. This is a process where rules and fairness apply more than in any other place you can imagine, with the government having the constant, never-shifting burden of proof with respect to all this. Lisa Costello, I abandoned this before. Was he telling a fib when he says he pays her in cash? After you heard Rita Jensen say that she used to get a check, but cash also, they were very generous with her. When Nicole Barrett, the maid who came in, the housekeeper, excuse me, who came in 2002, she comes in and she's being paid in cash. I mean, it is not unprecedented that housekeepers get paid in currency. Okay? And the fact is that even during the 2000 and 2002 period, when Vince is talking about Lisa Costello and Roseanne says in that email where Lisa says your house never looked better and Vince is writing to Dottie, he'd like to get this woman, Anna, who's someone who's going to go back to Poland or something, to come in and be his housekeeper, and he says that Lisa doesn't do much when she's here anyway. The evidence fits together here. She's being paid in currency for what she's doing. She's got checks that are listed on Kenyon, and Vince says, you know, not every one of those things are Kenyon Avenue, because you'll see some months like March and others are covered by that summary the government prepared of checks she's receiving. But she's doing the work. And the government says, you can take it from us as an article of faith because we tell you that she's not putting in the required time. And Vince explains what part of the problem is, that she's got a gambling problem. And how dare he do these things? What kind of an extended family? He's accusing her, of being a gambling problem person. That's how the government deals with Lisa Costello. The independent contractors who you heard about and who you heard testify. It's a really interesting exercise. The government calls Howard Kane. Howard Kane. Howard Kane was with my client from almost the beginning. Howard Kane is, as Mr. Zosmer says,
a political animal. Chris Craig says, politics and government are inextricably intertwined. There is hardly anything I do that is not political. That's the nature of elective government. So the question is, what's permissible and what's not permissible? What's Howard Kane doing, and what Howard Kane does is Howard Kane giving the Senate what he's supposed to be giving the Senate to earn the contract that he's getting. So what happens in this case is simply this. Howard Kane gets himself into some serious trouble. Howard Kane, who has worked with my client on all sorts of things, political campaign things, and he is involved in his agenda in the Senate. There is no question. He admits it. The vouchers prove it. There is no getting around it. He helps get people elected, and then what happens in his official capacity as a Senate contractor, he gets those people to support my client's agenda. People like Senator Washington call him in, will then support my agenda. It's all inextricably intertwined, and it's so clear to everybody except the government in this case, exactly the way the Senate and elective government works. So they say that Howard Kane was a $402,750 theft by him. And they get there by doing this. They say, listen to what Howard Kane has told you. He's always involved in political campaign work. That's what they tell you. Always involved in some political campaign. That's what the government says. The political campaign work could be as much as 1,000 hours a year. You're going to hear about this in a few minutes. As much as 1,000 hours a year. But also, when he speaks to the government, when he becomes a cooperator, he says certain things. And I want you to fix your mind on this in the short time we have left today, exactly what happens. Howard Kane has this huge secret, this witness for the government, who the government says you should believe. Howard Kane, unbeknownst to my client, who's paying all this money in taxes himself, Howard Kane decides that he's exempt. He hasn't paid any federal income taxes since 1991, and the federal government catches him. Now Howard Kane is really, I mean, he's stepping into that stuff those farmers have city folks step into when they testified and they charge, you know, the bulldozer and that extra $12,000. He really has stepped into it. He's in big trouble. I mean, how are you going to explain to anybody, without a lot of help from the government plugging away for you, that you just didn't pay any taxes at all from 1991 through 2008 when he becomes a cooperator for the government? The government decides to charge him with one count of tax evasion, even though what's not barred by the statute of limitations would allow them to charge him for 6 years, because that's how far you can go back. Now he's facing one count, 5 years, but that's not all. He wants some help from the government because he's made a deal. And if you don't think, based on what you've heard, that it's a big deal to have the government plugging away for you at sentencing, if in fact you're a cooperator, even though the judge is the one who's going to have to impose the sentence, you obviously know that that's the way this works. The government is going to be plugging away for him at sentencing because he's given them the guy they're looking for. And what does Howard Kane do? He starts doing his cooperating. And what does he do? Now he's really got to be truthful with the government. He's got to level with the government. He's got to do what the government wants him to do. He's not going to get cooperation credits. And what does he do when he sits down with the government? He explains, although there has never been a rule in the Senate requiring people to itemize in 2004, based on all the stuff that's happening, that office, the FUMA office, starts to require contractors, though not required to do it by the Senate, to itemize their bills. And what happens when the government meets with Howard Kane? And I asked him about it from, you know, the 302.
McGovern says, it's not his report, it's not his report. He agreed that this is what he said. You don't have to put anything on the screen. Now, we're talking about the invoices from 2004-1. He's a cooperator now. It's 2008. He's giving a statement to the government, March and April 2008, and he's got to cooperate with the government to get his cooperation credits, to get his break. Here's what he first says to the government. When first asked, this is Agent Humphrey's report, when first asked about his SDAC invoices, Kane initially said his billings to the SDAC were legitimate. Kane believed when he wrote his invoices that someone would question them later. Because they're, you know, they're buzzing around now. He tells them at a time when he wants to cooperate with the government, which requires that he must dump on that guy who he's been with all these years, he tells the government that each and every one of the entries in those invoices from 2004 on, when they started doing it, is legitimate Senate work. He says that. But what happens? Next sentence. Upon further questioning, however, and we're not there. Upon further questioning, however, Kane admitted that his SDAC invoices included items that should not have been billed to the Senate Democratic Appropriation Committee. Well, what happened between the first sentence and the second sentence? Gina Novelli, the government likes to put words in your mouth. Charlie Shoulders, you heard what he said when he pointed over there about how they try to put words in your mouth. I don't like saying this, but it's very clear what happened. Upon further questioning, all of a sudden that 100% of the billings in the invoices were legitimate, covering SDAC work, says Howard Kane. And then upon further questioning, however, he admitted that his SDAC invoices included items that should not have been billed. Kane initially estimated that about 80% of the items billed on his invoices represented legitimate services provided to the Senate Democratic Appropriations Committee. So now we're down from 100 to 80 in two lines upon further questioning. Wouldn't you have loved to have been a fly on the wall to find out what the further questioning was like? You are a cooperator. You think you're going to get cooperation credits from us on the deal that you made with us? 100% of these billings are legitimate? Oh, down to 80%. Now, two paragraphs later, I asked Kane about this, you remember. Kane was asked to estimate the split of his time between legislative work and political campaign work while under contract with the SDAC from 1999 forward. Kane initially estimated the split to be about 50-50. Now, let's just stop there. From 1999, before he's doing invoicing, he says his work is 50-50. Now, when you hear what I have to say, hopefully, and you understand how he puts these numbers together, Kane, you'll come to understand that it is reasonable for you to assume that Kane has worked at least 1,000 hours on political campaign work, and if 50-50 is the right number, at $150 an hour, he's given the Senate Democratic Appropriations Committee $150,000 of services a year. In his highest year, he had an $80,000 contract. Where's the fraud? But wait a minute. 50-50? Upon further questioning, and after being shown his SDAC invoices for July of 2004 through February 2006, Kane estimated that approximately 50% of his total billed hours was spent doing political campaign-related work, 25% was spent doing work for private clients, and 25% doing legitimate legislative work for the SDAC. So now we go from in 1999 through the period of time that they're questioning him. Now we're going from 50-50 for the whole period. Now, upon further questioning, it's now reduced to 25%. What happened? So now, here's what we do. The government is examining his invoices, if you remember. Now, this is the period of time when they start itemizing time. And if you go to 656, Defense Exhibit 656.8, you will see the things that Howard Kane is doing and what he later says about all of these things. And what Howard Kane says is this. These are the things that he's doing July 2004. And you see what this is. Just to get started. Discussion with staff regarding gaming operations in Philadelphia. VJF discussing upcoming communication needs. That's part of what he does. He's a message guy. Philadelphia staff regarding Philadelphia Regional Port Authority, Delaware River Port Authority. We know that's an interest of Howard Kane's, right? He's a Port Authority guy. He was involved even back in the 90s in trying to get Meyer Werth to bring, you know, its shipbuilding here to the Navy Yard. You remember that? And you can go on and on. You can just look at this. I don't want to read every one of these things. My voice is going. So here we are, you know, the Senator Stack staff regarding project coordination. Because he's a senator now, too, Stack. And their fellow senators within Philadelphia, Democrats, okay? Representatives of the trial lawyers. Well, that's what he's doing. Senator Boscola's staff regarding gaming issues. Because you know what's going on in 2004. Senator Fumo is involved in getting gaming, whether we like it or not, to Pennsylvania, for tax reasons, you know, to fill the coffers instead of everything going over to New Jersey. Meeting with representatives of the Philadelphia Food Distribution Center, and we know that that's something that the senator is interested in and involved in because of what you heard Ken Snyder say. Members of the Pennsylvania Partnership regarding gaming. Firefighters, Philadelphia firefighters, a press conference. Obviously, this is all verifiable. You're going to say you're meeting with the Firefighters Association, a press conference? And all of a sudden, you know, not think that somebody would be there to contradict you? A meeting with Philadelphia Chief of Staff regarding upcoming issues. And it goes on. And if you go through this in excruciating detail, you see things like if you go to page 8 of this, page 232. Now I'm in July 2005. I'm skipping over a lot of stuff. He's involved in all these things. Issue development projects. Tioga Marine Terminal. That's a long... You know, the Delaware River, where that shredder was, CIM, which is Camden Iron and Metal site. Now, Kane, as it turns out, separately has a contract with them. But it's something that is of grave interest to my client because there's this giant shredder in his district, and they need to move it. Next, meeting with Harrisburg staff regarding railroad settlement talks. Meeting with Harrisburg staff... And you can see regarding Pima budget and operations. Going down further, Philadelphia Police Aviation Unit meeting conversations. Philadelphia helicopter and mayor's sign-off. London taxi project. Remember my client had this interest to bring these modern, spruced up, for tourism purposes, Philadelphia, London taxi cabs. People would, you know, do tours with people coming in from out of town. And then we find out also... that he's got a separate contract, Kane does, with the parking authority for this taxi cab project that Fumo is involved in and interested in. But nonetheless, a matter of interest to the Senate Democratic. Theater for the Deaf. Councilman Kenny. PGW and LNG terminal issues. Independent Seaport regarding funding. Photos of Children's press event with photos at Children's Village. You remember... What's going on is that Senator Fumo is doing a public interest service message that they're filming from the Children's Village, reminding people that they can provide through tax credits by checking off a box on the returns in the state that certain money will go for preschoolers. And he does this. That's what, and Kane is involved in filming it because that's one of the things that he does. Obviously legitimate stuff. And we can go through this in great detail, of course. You know, Kane doesn't pay his taxes. He doesn't worry about, you know, checking off anything. But this is something that Senator Fumo is reminding people of, you know, in the community that they can benefit children if they check off that box. And you can go through these invoices. These invoices that Cain says, when he first speaks to the government, reflect legitimate SDAC work, period, before upon further questioning begins. What you do when you see these invoices is that you begin to appreciate the breadth and the scope of the legitimate Senate work that this guy is doing all of these years for Senator Fumo, the intersection of where politics and government come together. In addition to doing political campaign work that makes him valuable enough to be able to do that job and earn his keep. But more importantly, the government says, what blessed reason would Howard Cain ever do these campaigns for, like, a senator here or a candidate over there, for free? You remember what Senator Fumo said? He's back with me in 1984 where we put together a campaign for Roxanne Jones. She becomes a senator, and then I get that extra vote, and I became chairman of the Appropriations Committee. Howard was with me then. And why would Howard do all this stuff? Well, of course, there is the obvious. For you to have any value in the job that you're to do as the liaison with other people and all the public policy issues that Senator Fumo has, getting people to support his agenda, you've got to be this political animal, which is what you are. Getting people to support his agenda, having him support the agendas of other people who are senators. But what's he do? We find out that he is getting commissions from Kennedy Printing. The government says, hey, it's only $95,000 for five or six years or whatever it is. Tax-free, of course. Not bad, right? Why else would he do this stuff? Why else would he do these campaigns? Well, he has independent contracts on the side. Why would he do Kenny's campaign, the city councilman? Why would he do work for Frank DiCicco, the guy that Jacobs keeps calling DiCicco incorrect? DiCicco, Frank DiCicco and Jim Kenny, their city councilman. Why would he do their political campaign stuff for the $95,000 and all the things that he's getting in Kennedy Printing? Why would he do it? Let me count the ways. What happens? Comcast hires of all of the people who are lobbyists or political people in the world, when they want to lobby city council to keep some other company from coming into their territory, do you remember that? Who do they hire but Howard Cain? Why does Howard Cain become a valuable commodity to Comcast? Who's on city council? They want him to lobby city council. Who's on city council? The people that he wanted to get elected to city council, his allies like Kenny and DiCicco. Why would Howard Cain do this political campaign work for free, other than the Kennedy Printing, of course? Let me count the ways. He's getting a contract from one of the biggest companies in the world. Because they know, to use Dan Whalen's expression, he's got facial recognition from the decision makers who are going to be deciding whether or not Comcast can keep out some small competitor. Unbeknownst, he claims, even to my client, he gets hired by Isle of Capri. Now, this is Donald Trump's company. Don't blame Donald Trump. I don't want to get upset. His lobbyists hire Howard Cain to do what? To monitor gaming legislation. Why would they hire Howard Cain to monitor gaming operations? Why, of all of the people in the world, would they hire Howard to keep track of what's going on with gaming legislation development? Who's developing gaming legislation? Who's going to have everything to say, or some of what to say, along with the governor and the other Senate leaders about who gets licenses? There's a guy named Trump who is involved in the gaming industry. He hires Howard Cain at $10,000 a month with an American Express card. And why do you think they hired him? Mr. Gaming in Pennsylvania. Is he involved in that? Cain admits, when he talks to the government, that being associated with FUMO gave him access to people who wanted to come to him. Howard Cain is doing campaign work for people for his own chits. Remember he said, I do this political campaign work so that he has IOUs later on for his own power. What about you? What are you getting for that free political campaign work you're doing? Just like what's he getting for the free political campaign work he does for other people. It's all part of that synergism. And Howard Cain gets contract after contract. Government says he doesn't get it until like 2003. Who says so? Howard Cain? He hasn't been doing this forever? Of course that's what he's in this for. And then it really gets interesting. It gets interesting because what the government does is this. All those invoices, the ones that when he first looked at them, when he sat down with the government, 100% of this is legitimate Senate Democratic Appropriations Committee work. And if you see that this is the kind of stuff that he's been doing over the years, you see exactly how this is official-related stuff, constituent-related, it's economic and community development-related, it's Port Authority work, it's all those things. He's the guy, if you remember, who admits, not what Mr. Zosmer said, that wasn't the exact, he said for 1 year, back in 99, he did work on the first Christopher Columbus Charter School, the lower school, before Ruth took over and did the second one, where Rosemary Dougherty is now. He says that he worked at least 10 hours a week for as much as 2 years. That was my question to him. Not a year, 10 hours a week, you know, every week for about 2 years. He's earning his contract just on that alone before you get to any of this stuff. If you do it at $150 an hour. He's also, during the same period of time, 99 through 2001, is what you heard is reapportionment time. And he's a big figure. Why? He is FUMO's agent because FUMO's in charge. He's a point man for reapportionment. And the judge asked the question, what happens to those reapportionment cases when people balk? They end up here in federal court. It's a big deal about, you know, one man, one vote, and things like that, to make sure districts reflect, you know, the fairness about what, you know, the vote should be all about. It's a very hard job. Why do they need a political animal like Howard Cain to do that job? Sometimes you have to convince elected officials maybe to cast a vote which will vote them out of office because their district's getting rearranged. It's a complex process. This is right at the intersection of how government and politics come together. That's the value of Howard Cain. But now what does the government do? They say to Howard Cain, now that you will have conceded that the work you did after further questioning wasn't 100%, and now after you've conceded that it may be, you know, as low as, you know, 50-50, or it may be as low as 25% for the Senate now, magically within two paragraphs, let's do a rating. Sit down with the invoices, Howard. Do us a little favor. Put down in the margin by reconstructing in 2008, when they sit down with them, take this home or do whatever you want and put in the margin what you're doing. And what we want you to do is this is the code. One will be purely political. And by the way, purely political might be fine if it's not political campaign. But if it's purely political, let's assume for the sake of argument that's political campaign. And number two in the margin would be he's doing the work, but there's a secondary client that has hired him. That's my deviation. Okay? Client. So he's getting it two ways. And three is, you know, official Senate work, SDAC work, or, you know, Castro Street work, or whatever. You know, this is okay, he says. The three is a good thing to get. It's good to get a three on this test. And four is, I have no recollection. No. Election. government gives him this assignment, and what does Howard Kane do? Now it's no longer 100%. He puts ones down. He puts twos down. And if you'll just look at this, and I hope that this will be the end of the day, this is a preview of what you're going to see tomorrow. And that's Defense Exhibit 656.9. This is Howard Kane, the guy who's in deep trouble with the federal government, the guy who starts out by saying all of these are legitimate SDAC invoices. He now puts this rating down. And you see what he does. And then what happens is that we give him a pop quiz. And you remember how that turned out when we had him re-rated, when he didn't have those numbers on the screen that he had when he sat down and worked this out with the government. And I'll get to that first thing tomorrow morning if the judge is ready to recess.
Very well. 10 o'clock tomorrow. Anything to be discussed?
Yes, sir.
Two issues, Your Honor. One is the one we raised before about the problem, the exhibits and the PC card regarding the attorney-client matter. The other issue is the request that we made for an additional instruction regarding the Ethics Act. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Your Honor's had a chance to read it. We filed a motion.
I didn't read thoroughly because there was a response I haven't read yet.
So. Yeah, if we could address that before the government's rebuttal, I would appreciate that. We don't.
I'll address it before the government's rebuttal, but my inclination is probably not to add anything to the instruction I gave because I think it would just confuse things in that area. I thought the instruction I gave was fairly simple and clear. And
well, can I be heard on that now then, Your Honor?
Yeah, I don't see what point do you wish to make? One point only that with regard to superseding, is that the only point you wish
That's
to make?
That's the critical point. The critical point is that these two acts work in combination. Mr. Jacobs said the opposite to the jury. Mr. Kogan did not do that today. He just kind of muddled it. But Mr. Jacobs specifically said that John Contino agreed with him that the more narrow act controls over the broader act, which Contino, in fact, did not agree with him on. And then tried to say that the Legislative Code of Ethics is controlling. That's not the law. That was not addressed in Your Honor's instruction.
You can all be heard.
Your Honor's instruction, by the time you decided what you were going to include, did not address the interplay of the two acts with each other.
That's right. Did not. And that much is true, Mr. Jacobs.
That's not an accurate rendition of what I said in my closing argument or what I asked the witness on cross-examination. I have a very clear recollection of showing Mr. Contino the second Ethics Act, the one that I referred to as my Ethics Act, mm-hmm. And asking him if this was more specific than the act that applied to the all the employees in the state of Pennsylvania. And he agreed that it was. And then I simply said to him, you know, when you were in law school, you know, did you learn the proposition that when there is a general statute governing an event and a more specific one, as a general rule, the more specific statute is the one that should be applied. And he agreed with all of that. That was the examination, and those were the remarks I made to the jury in my closing argument. It was all well within.
Well, I guess the real question is whether I should make a brief amendment to my instruction.
Judge, this was well known.
To instruct relative to whether or not one of them supersedes the other.
Your Honor, as applied to this.
But Mr. Goldberger has written, I believe.
He's written a response, which I haven't read.
Two memos.
I haven't read it.
The facts.
That's why I wasn't prepared to address this other than on the one side.
The facts of the law are no different this minute than they were when we did the charge conference.
I'll look at Mr. Goldberger's memorandum. And in response to your request, Mr. Zalber, I'll let you know before you address the jury.
Just,
I'll probably let you know tomorrow morning.
Just one more point, Your Honor. there absolutely is a proposition of law that a more specific provision controls over a more general. It's not applicable to these two acts at all. And Mr. Jacobs argued it to the jury for the specific purpose of suggesting that it is. And that is not, in fact, there's no testimony in this case. Even Mr. Fumo agreed.
Yeah, well, I understand. I do understand the argument you're making, but I said I only looked at your brief. I didn't look at Mr. Goldberger's response.
All right, now the other issue.
As to the other matter you made reference to, are you saying that Mr. Kogan used an exhibit that wasn't in evidence?
No, he made an argument based on evidence that's unavailable to the government and to the jury. His argument was that Exhibit 1550 is this email that said, Mr. Fumo said, don't wipe Howard Kane's computer,
right.
There might be a subpoena for it.
Yeah.
In addition, there's a later email, I think it's February 4th of 2005, where he has suggested, I don't know that it says what he says it said, but that, again, Mr. Fumo is trying to preserve evidence. With respect to both of these emails, he made the argument that they were not found on Mr. Fumo's PC card. And these are communications between Fumo and lawyers,
mm-hmm.
or Fumo lecturer mm-hmm. lawyers. And that because they were not found on Mr. Fumo's PC card, the jury can conclude from that Mr. Fumo was not making an effort to only carefully select
right,
the items
okay.
he was keeping.
Now, what's your problem with that?
The problem is we don't know if it's on his PC card or not, because pursuant to the law and pursuant to Your Honor's order regarding the attorney-client privilege, we've never been able to look at the PC card with respect to any communications between any of the defendants and any of the lawyers in the case.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be on the PC card, it may not. There also may be an abundance of interesting evidence on the PC card regarding this whole advice of counsel issue. We were limited, I think appropriately, by Your Honor, to receiving a production from Mr. Fumo and from the Sprague Law Firm of items that were within the narrow exception that Your Honor carved to the attorney-client privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we know. And so the jury is being given an inaccurate impression of what the evidence is. We don't know if it's on the PC card or not, and yet they're being asked to draw an inference against us
okay.
as if it's not there.
I must say, I'm lost. The fact of the matter is the heart of this matter is the communication which is taking place in 2004 between Luchko and Fumo and Charlie Hoffman. That's the critical part of it, where my client thinks this is under subpoena or it may be covered by subpoena. That's 1550. Now, what does that have to do with what's on his PC card regarding the lawyer-client privilege? If Sprague's involved in this conversation, that wouldn't be part of a privilege anyway in this case, because it's something shared with a third party who's not the lawyer. That's part of it. The other one that I made reference to, which is 1599, if I remember, that's a communication at the time of this conspiracy is allegedly ongoing between Luchko and Fumo. And the only question that's asked of Sprague is a simple question. Why can't we get copies of these emails of Ruth Arnao's that they're doing? So this is a mystery to me as to what they weren't allowed to get into. So I took it as an article of faith when we didn't hear a word about that, that was legitimately what the conclusion was from this, and that is it wasn't on his PC card. And that's it.
Your Honor, there is no third party. The Luchko was a co-defendant. Everybody knows the rules we abided by. We have advised, and it's on the record, we advised Judge Davis, who was the grand jury judge, and we advised the Third Circuit.
Well, let me ask you this. What if your argument is correct, what's the remedy?
The remedy, I think, is for Your Honor to tell the jury in one paragraph, which I'm happy to draft if Your Honor would like, in one paragraph to say there is no, because of legal strictures, there is no evidence in this case regarding what attorney-client emails were preserved on Mr. Fumo's PC card, and therefore the jury should not draw an inference one way or the other regarding whether he preserved emails on his PC card involving communications with his attorneys. That the evidence that we have in this case regarding attorney-client communication was produced by the Sprague firm pursuant to Your Honor's oversight.
Wait a minute. This is stuff that was generated back then. This is before you even got involved in this case and issued any order. I'm totally mystified by what they're saying here.
He's not mystified. He made the argument, Your Honor. He's the one.
Don't tell me I'm not mystified if I say I'm mystified.
He probably is mystified, but the problem is.
Thank you, Joe.
The problem is The question is what is the, whether or not he's mystified. This question still is whether it was a misstatement and of the agreement here with regard to the attorney-client privilege rules that, that this court had laid down. And if it was such a misstatement, then it ought to be clarified.
That's,
to the jury.
That's really unfair, Judge.
No, I'm not saying he made a misstatement. I'm just saying that if it was.
That's really unfair. Your Honor, he made an argument in support of his client, trying to get a not guilty verdict, trying to get an inference that Mr. Fumo was not selectively keeping things on his PC card based on evidence that is not in the record and that we cannot contradict based on what we assured the Third Circuit. We had arguments about this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure, you know, Mr. Kogan was not in the case at that time, but it's a record. We told the court and Judge Davis how we were approaching the review at the time that our mere possession of these items was being challenged by Mr. Fumo and his attorneys. And we laid out exactly what we were doing, and the Third Circuit permitted it.
So what the government is representing to you is this, that the communications with Luchka at the time that these were supposedly statements in furtherance of a conspiracy were not on Luchko's PC cards, his backups. The government is representing to you affirmatively that they never had the stuff. Is that right?
No, we are representing that any communication of these people in the joint defense agreement, Fumo, Luchko, Eichster, Arnao, anyone, any communication involving any of them or a group of them and any of their attorneys was never reviewed by the government pursuant to the protocol that was advised to the court and that was approved and was followed for years. And they know that we don't know whether any of this information is on any of the materials.
Well,
Justin Price testified.
You submit your proposed
I think 1550 came right off of Kane's laptop.
And,
that's correct. That's where it came from. That's why we have
Kane's
it.
Laptop.
That's right. But you can't say that it's not on Fumo's PC card when we don't know that and couldn't tell the jury that. That's what you argue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand your point, and that's why I want to look at your instruction.
Thank you very much,
Wes. Okay, gentlemen, see you tomorrow at 10.